What's up, Bitcoiners? Today's episode with Vijay Boyapati is brought to you by Ledin.io, a better home for your Bitcoin. Ledin is a secure, simple, and easy-to-use platform for managing and growing your digital wealth. With industry-best interest rates on savings, use your Bitcoin as collateral for loans, or double your Bitcoin stack with their Buy2X program. And Ledin raises the bar for transparency in the industry with proof of reserves attestation. Not yet a Ledin client? Start earning 9% APY on your USDC and 6.1% APY on your first two Bitcoin. Listeners of the Bitcoin Matrix podcast get an exclusive offer of $50 free in USDC when you become a Ledin user and take out a Ledin loan using our link. Learn more, sign up, and get earning at start.ledin.io/Bitcoin Matrix. And now, in this very special chat with Vijay Boyapati, we reflect on where we are in this current cycle, and we take a deep dive into the history of the cypherpunk movement, Satoshi, and Bitcoin's nuclear option.
What is real? How do you define real?
You can't jump into cash. Cash is trash. What do? You get out.
Born and raised in Australia, Vijay Boyapati moved to the United States in 2000 to pursue a PhD in computer science. Instead of enrolling in a doctoral program, Vijay ended up at a small startup called Google, where he spent several years using his background in machine learning to improve the ranking algorithms used in Google News. Boyapati left his lucrative job in 2007 to work on a grassroots campaign in the 2008 presidential election, helping to raise millions of dollars and bring hundreds of volunteers to New Hampshire to canvass for Ron Paul. In 2011, Vijay discovered Bitcoin and went down the proverbial rabbit hole in a quest to understand how a new form of internet money, backed by no commodity and guaranteed by no government, could have any economic value. Armed with a background in Austrian economics, Vijay penned The Bullish Case for Bitcoin as a long-form article in 2017 to provide the layperson with an economic framework with which they could understand Bitcoin. He is a husband and loving father. Vijay Boyapati, welcome back to the Bitcoin Matrix podcast for the third time. How are you?
Thanks for having me, Cedric. It's always great to chat with you.
Yeah, man. It's super exciting to catch up with you. You were on episode 42, The Bullish Case for Bitcoin, which is my most downloaded episode ever. And episode 61, Bitcoin Valuation Frameworks and Cycles, my number three most downloaded episode ever. So it's really exciting to have you back. I really do think you're one of the best explainers in the space and very articulate about what Bitcoin is and sort of what monetary networks are and network effects and properties of money. This conversation, I'd like to focus on some of the historical aspects of money, specifically around the problems that Satoshi solved. But I'd love to catch up. It's been a few months since we spoke. I got my copies of the book. The artwork is awesome. The foreword by Michael Saylor is great. I'd love to read just a quick piece from there. In a clear and concise manner, Vijay presents the theory of money, the anatomy of Bitcoin, the reasons it is superior to the gold and fiat standards that came before it, and the promise it offers to human civilization. He describes path dependence and the trajectory of a newly monetizing asset in terms the layman can understand. And he addresses the concerns that most commonly arise as newcomers struggle to comprehend the essence and significance of this first digital monetary network. You know, and then I think he handed out the article to everyone on the board and his offices of the company. You know, I just love to catch up on, you know, Bitcoin's now at $1 trillion. We're 6 months from the all-time high, hash rates at an all-time high. What's your reflections at this point?
It's been an interesting bull market. It hasn't quite been like any of the other ones. And this is one of the things that I reflect on frequently, is that we've never seen the process of monetization happen as quickly as is happening with Bitcoin. So we're learning, and you know, a lot of people thought that this cycle would look exactly like the last one. And then when it didn't really look like the last one, they thought maybe it looks like the 2013 cycle. We don't know. We're learning. And we don't know whether the effect of the halving, which we know is a very important causal factor in these hype cycles, we don't know if that's going to continue to be the case in the future. Eventually, the halving is not going to have such a huge impact on the inflation rate, because when you go from, you know, 0.5% inflation to 0.25% inflation, that's perhaps not significant enough to trigger a market cycle. So we don't know when that's going to happen. And I think this is absolutely fascinating. When does Bitcoin get to a kind of scale where it stabilizes and its growth doesn't involve these big, like, parabolic moves followed by crashes and then prolonged periods of sort of despair and, you know, from the price perspective, this long plateau? We don't know. I'm a student of economics and I'm learning, and I think, you know, my reflection is that we don't know how this cycle is going to play out. Perhaps it does play out like the other ones, it's just slower. But we will learn that over the next 6 months to a year. I would be very surprised if we've seen the end of the cycle. That is, if we've seen the top already, I'd be very, very surprised. None of the signs that you would expect in a top have been seen. And some of the signs you would expect in a market top is just sloppiness of trading. Large inter-exchange spreads where one exchange has a much higher price than another exchange, exchanges going down, all these issues that we've seen in prior cycles that, you know, very clearly marked the top, and just, you know, a frenzy of news and enthusiasm, and you know, front page on the New York Times, Wall Street Journal, every newspaper around the world saying you need to buy Bitcoin. We haven't seen anything like that yet. So I'd be very surprised if we're at the top of this cycle. But, you know, as I said, I'm a student and we will see. We will see.
Yeah. The news cycle has been very strange. Things have not gone the way you would expect in terms of when big news has hit. We haven't really ran. And that's kind of been interesting. To me, my impression has been with this long grind through the summer, the way this cycle's gone. You know, you mentioned 2013, I think there was a 9x in Q4, and 2017, I think it was a 4x. And I don't know what happened this Q4, but I think this is showing that we could be in a longer, more grinding cycle right to the next halving, is one way I'm looking at it, where we just grind up slowly like a spiral, maybe. I'm not really sure. What about the sort of macroeconomic environment right now? Are you seeing any sort of like canaries in the coal mine? I mean, the debt ceiling, I don't know. We always seem to go through this, so it doesn't seem too irregular to me. Evergrande, that kind of seemed like something that could be big, but it now seems like maybe a blip. Are you seeing anything outside of Bitcoin that's kind of looking different right now?
Yeah, I think the big macroeconomic factor to consider is whether the Federal Reserve is at the end of its loose monetary policy cycle and whether they intend to sort of pull back from that and sort of taper their quantitative easing. It's very hard to know. The Federal Reserve has tried to indicate numerous times over the last 6 months or year that they want to begin tapering. But every time they do, the market kind of reacts very negatively. And then they say, well, maybe now is not the time, or now there's a new COVID variant, maybe now is not the time. And they come up with all of these excuses. But that's certainly a potential headwind. If the Federal Reserve changes their mind and starts tightening, or perhaps not being so loose, that will generally have a negative effect on monetary goods. The question is, though, is certainly it would have a negative effect on something like gold. Now, the question is, does Bitcoin have enough scale that it is affected by these large macro monetary phenomena like the Federal Reserve tightening? Certainly gold is. And Bitcoin, for most of its history, has been small enough that the macro factors didn't really affect it, because it was almost like a startup company. And a startup company that's doing really well, is very successful, has such a gigantic addressable market that it's moving into, that even if the macro picture turns poor, the startup has this, you know, market which is just trying to saturate, and it's so far away from saturating it that it doesn't matter. You think about an example I like to think about is Google. I worked at Google, you know, 2 decades ago, and Google was in this hyper growth mode during the dot-com crash. And the dot-com crash did not affect Google at all. In fact, it was incredibly positive for Google, because there were all of these very talented engineers who'd been laid off at other companies in Silicon Valley. And Google really had the pick of the best, the cream of the crop, of the engineering talent in Silicon Valley. And even though the economy had this major, major downturn, it didn't affect Google, because it was 10Xing every year. So it didn't even notice. So to bring this back to Bitcoin's been like that. There have been a number of times over the last decade when it appeared that the economy might be slowing down and the stock market had a major correction. In general, it didn't matter. Bitcoin continued its like 10x every, you know, few years, just because it was in that hyper growth mode. The question is, when does Bitcoin get to the size that macroeconomic factors affect it? My belief is that once it approaches the scale of gold, then we should expect that macroeconomic factors will affect Bitcoin. But we're not there yet. So I would be surprised if it's going to have a huge impact on Bitcoin at this stage. But again, this is, you know, we're students of monetary economics here. So it could be the case that $1 trillion is sufficient scale that Bitcoin would be affected by a tightening of the Federal Reserve. But so that there's the open question, does the Federal Reserve tighten? And would that impact Bitcoin if they did?
Yeah, that's fascinating. And I always wonder around the halving and how impactful that is in terms of whether, if Satoshi had chosen to do a more steady decline in issuance from each block, and then the impact that would have had. I'm just fascinated by that decision. And we're so early on, it's so hard to know what the difference would have been or in outcomes. And both probably seem genius level in a lot of ways, especially in the short term. I think the halving every 4 years, just playing on politics and monetary policy and short-term thinking in that regard. But I'm not sure. In terms of these problems though, you know, when I was growing up, you know, we heard the expression, you know, history is over. And I kind of had this impression that most, you know, huge human problems were solved. And until, you know, I looked at Bitcoin and really studied monetary history, I didn't really think about certain problems that were being attempted to be solved before Bitcoin. And I'd love to turn our attention to some of these pioneers and where what they set out to do and what they accomplished. So maybe you could tell us a little bit about like David Chaum and what he designed in the early 80s.
Yeah, sure. So I just wanted to make comment on what you said, you know, the idea that history is over and that all of our problems have been solved. Maybe this could be a topic for another chat between us, but I think the truth is that our biggest problems are ahead of us. And I think humanity has some really big problems that we will need to address. Bitcoin is part of the solution, but one of the things that I fear a lot is that we're moving to a world of asymmetries where individuals can do asymmetric good, but they can also do asymmetric bad. And that we really need to think about what the world will look like when individuals can really do a lot of harm with, you know, a small amount of technology. But anyway, that's a topic for another podcast. David Chaum was one of the pioneers of digital currency, and he created a company called DigiCash, and the first product was eCash. And it was a product which used cryptography to allow people to transact privately. And in the early days, the cypherpunks were really concerned about privacy and the ability to conduct business with people over the internet privately because they thought that we were moving to a world with the internet where the government would sort of take on this big brother role and would be snooping in everything we did. And ironically, it turns out to be just the case of the world we live in today. And so they were really concerned with using cryptography to allow people to conduct financial transactions. And you have to sort of go back to the context of, you know, the late 80s and early 90s when cryptography was a politically charged topic. The idea that this strong encryption mm-hmm. that we now take for granted and anyone is allowed to use was considered a military technology, and to export it was almost treasonous. Mm-hmm. And so these pioneers, you know, really pushed the envelope and made it clear that this is more about free speech, that cryptography was a form of speech. And they, you know, put the code to encrypt messages on a t-shirt that so that you could see, right. Look, this is what it is. It's just some speech that I'm putting on my t-shirt, but that speech is very powerful because it allows you to hide the contents of any message in a way that even the most powerful governments could not crack. So this is also connected. I want to talk a little bit about Tim May, who wrote a very influential document in, I think it was 1992, and it was called the Anarchist Manifesto. And Tim May presented this to a bunch of cypherpunks and radicals in Silicon Valley. And this manifesto described the use of cryptography to build a new society, which was voluntary and used free markets over the internet, which are protected by cryptography. And this was just a mind-blowing idea that you could even do this. It wasn't a world like we have today where we take cryptography for granted and we have all of these apps like Signal where we just assume that if we want to do something privately, we can do it. It wasn't like that at all. And he envisaged a world where money would be created through cryptography. And David Chaum was the first one to attempt this. The interesting thing about eCash was it wasn't really decentralized in any way. It allowed people to conduct transactions with each other privately, but there was a sort of central custodian which determined who had how much, and that was the company. And the problem with this situation is that the company wasn't actually very successful. It eventually went bankrupt. And what that meant was the monetary system that he invented using cryptography just disappeared overnight because it was based on this centralized system that he had created. And while it was pioneering in that it allowed privacy of transactions, digital transactions, it did have this fundamental flaw that it wasn't decentralized. Now, these cypherpunks who were motivated by the Anarchist Manifesto recognized this, and they recognized during the 90s, mid to late 90s, that this was a really important problem to solve. How do we solve the problem of not having a centralized point of failure? And there were numerous people who contributed to solving this problem. None of them came up with a complete solution, a complete working solution, but they provided critical pieces that would eventually be used in the design of Bitcoin by Satoshi Nakamoto. One of these attempts was by Adam Back, who invented Hashcash. And Hashcash was this kind of cool idea, which was not really originally designed as a way to create money, but it was a way to prevent email spam. And what you would do is you'd use hashing. It's a way to get a computer to expend a provable amount of energy and cost someone a provable amount of money, and attach the proof that this energy was expended to an email. And what that would mean is that for a regular person sending email, they would attach a hash, which had been computed by expending all this computer energy, and they could prove that they spent, say, a hundredth of a penny to send the email. And so no one would care about, you know, spending that much money when sending an email. But if you were a spammer and you're sending millions of emails, to pay that cost per email would be prohibitive. Yeah. So Hashcash was a really important idea in that you could prove that someone had consumed a certain amount of energy and therefore spent a certain amount of money. And the proof was a hash, which is a digital signature that you can send around to anyone and say this much energy was consumed. That was a really important step. And I don't think Adam Back fully appreciated how important that was, but it was a critical, critical breakthrough. Then there were other attempts at creating digital money by two people that I mentioned in the book, Wei Dai and Nick Szabo. And they're actually, their designs were kind of similar. They tried to create decentralized systems. And I can't remember if it was Nick Szabo or Wei Dai. I have to go back and look at the specific details, but they had ways of trying to manage who had how much, because that's the critical problem of a decentralized system of money, is who keeps track of who else has how much money. Mm-hmm. With a centralized system, mm-hmm. you just have a database, right? And you say, Cedric has 10 eCash tokens and VJ has 5 eCash tokens. It's very easy to do that. But in a decentralized system where you're trying to build money, you have to figure out a way that everyone stays honest. Because if you're in a decentralized system, everyone has a massive incentive to cheat and just say, well, I have a lot of money. And so Nick Szabo had a strategy for doing this called the Property Club. One of the problems with Nick Szabo's design was that it was quite complex. And his monetary units were essentially hashes, that is, tokens which were a certain amount of consumed energy. Mm-hmm. But the tokens weren't fungible with each other. So each of the tokens represented a different amount of energy. So it's kind of equivalent to thinking about diamonds versus gold. Each hash was like one diamond, and one diamond might be higher quality than another diamond. And so he had all of these intricate schemes that you could try and make it fungible, but it was incredibly complex. And he didn't end up actually implementing his design. But he came up with this really critical concept. And the concept was, and I'm trying to remember what it was called. It was
unforgeable costliness.
Unforgeable costliness. Yeah, I need to read my first chapter again. I haven't thought about the term in a while, but unforgeable costliness. And why is that important? Because one of the most important properties of money is scarcity. And in the physical realm, people think of scarcity in terms of a dearth of something. There isn't much of it. So there isn't much gold, so it's scarce.
Mm.
But Nick Szabo reframed this idea into a related but slightly different concept, which is something is scarce, not if there's a limited supply of it, but if it's costly to produce, if it's hard to produce, and if you can prove that there's a cost to producing it. And this relates back to Adam Back's Hashcash scheme, where you could create these tokens and prove that a certain amount of computational energy went into producing them. So Nick Szabo's concept of unforgeable costliness was a critical breakthrough in the development of money. And it's something that Satoshi used as well. And it's basically that you can use this to prove that a supply of digital tokens is scarce, because you can tie it to some hash where you can say that was a certain amount of energy expended, and we know that that had a certain cost. Now, we know that gold has a certain cost to produce. It's very, very costly to produce gold. In fact, you have to have a star explode to produce gold. So that's unforgeable costliness as well. It's something that's difficult to produce, and it's provably difficult to produce as well. So that was a really important concept. And it was interesting, these systems that had all sorts of problems, and they weren't, well designed. Mm. And by probably the mid-2000s to late-2000s, just as we were beginning to get into financial crisis, most of the people who'd been working on these problems had given up, and they thought that this wasn't a problem that could be solved. Decentralized money was not a problem that could be solved, because there'd been all these brilliant people who'd tried very hard to come up with a solution and were unsuccessful. And so in 2008, this mysterious figure comes out of nowhere and publishes this paper to the cryptography mailing list, which has all of these experts, cypherpunks and cryptographers and mathematicians and computer scientists who had seen all of these past attempts fail. And so they see this paper by Satoshi, which says, I've created a system which allows for peer-to-peer cash and there's no decentralized server. Most of the people on this cryptography mailing list were incredibly skeptical, and a number of them said this can't work, and they gave the reasons why it couldn't work. And it's funny, Greg Maxwell, who's a very prominent Bitcoin core developer now, was one of the people who was very skeptical that Satoshi had solved the problem of decentralized money. But there was one exception, and it was a guy named Hal Finney, who was a brilliant cryptographer and computer scientist. And he had been involved in a lot of the attempts to create digital money. He'd wanted this to happen, and he had kind of helped along the way, and he was fascinated every time someone came up with a new design and wanted to know how it worked. And so when Satoshi came up with this system, Hal Finney was one of the first people who's really interested and thought maybe this could work. And he, you know, sent a bunch of questions to Satoshi, and he was one of the first people to run a node. I think he was the first person to run a node. He was the first person to receive Bitcoins from Satoshi. He was the first person to tweet about Bitcoin. Hal Finney was an incredibly important figure in the space, just because he had this history and experience and knew about all the other attempts and the failings. And so he could see in Satoshi's design something different and something really important, a problem that Satoshi had solved that no one else had previously been able to solve. Now, unfortunately, Hal Finney wasn't with us for very long after he found out about Bitcoin. He passed away in 2011 from Lou Gehrig's disease. And, you know, a lot of people think he might be Satoshi Nakamoto. No one knows who Satoshi is. And they think, well, Hal has all the attributes that you might expect from someone who was Satoshi Nakamoto. He was brilliant. He was a polymath. He understood economics. He understood computer science. He'd tried to create digital money for many, many years. But I think we'll never know. So those are some of the figures who helped to provide the ideas that Satoshi built on. They are the giants on whose shoulders Satoshi stood when he created Bitcoin.
Yeah, that's the key word. So these are the giants that Satoshi, you know, stood on their shoulders. But how do you think they'll be remembered in history? You know, 100 years from now, Bitcoin is the standard. Will they be remembered in the way that I think a lot of people remember a Steve Jobs or a Bill Gates or whatever name you want to throw out there, like a Warren Buffett? You know, in a lot of regards, what these guys were doing to me seems like lonely work, you know, tinkering away by yourself. I don't know how much they were collaborating. I believe Adam Back was a mentee of David Chaum. I know that they were on mailing lists together, but I don't know if the camaraderie is like what we feel on Bitcoin Twitter with strangers, or I don't know if it was competitive. It's very interesting to me that what seems like this seems like such a daring project to put your incredible intellect into these problems that appear to be impossible to solve, that you're going to try to solve them and you run into a wall. And I'm kind of surprised that a lot of them gave up. Or appeared to give up. It just doesn't jive with the people that set out to, in my mind, solve these problems. But I'm kind of curious, how do you think they'll be remembered by the many and not so much the few who are involved in Bitcoin now?
Yeah, it's interesting because they all helped make progress on the problem, and the insights that they had were critical in Satoshi's ability to create Bitcoin, but they never succeeded. They didn't even sort of halfway succeed. Their attempts were mostly failures, where Satoshi made this sort of logical leap that none of them had been able to do. And by solving the problem, he essentially gets the lion's share of the credit, even though he built on the work of these guys. And I think, you know, they will all be part of the history books, but I don't think they'll have quite as large a role as Satoshi. I think, you know, to be fair, it would be better to think of Satoshi's invention as a progression. But really, I think history is going to see it as this giant leap that essentially came out of nowhere, and he solved this gigantic problem. And that's kind of how people talk about it today. And Satoshi's almost been deified, which is interesting. And it's part of the mysterious origin story of Bitcoin, that this person invented this digital money. It worked, even though everyone else who had tried it. And these people who had tried to create digital money were some of the smartest people you can imagine. They were all polymaths. They were geniuses, essentially, and very individualistic. They were people who would sort of sit in their own house thinking over this by themselves and come up with their own solution. That's, you know, when you think of Nick Szabo, when you think of Wei Dai, they figured that out on their own and said, this is what it should be to create digital money. And it wasn't like a collaboration in a lab with a bunch of engineers and a bunch of theoreticians. And the same thing was true really of Satoshi as well. I mean, he figured it out. He figured out this solution that in hindsight seems really beautiful and elegant, but it was a logical leap that no one else had made. And he figured that out by himself. You know, I think some people say, well, we don't know if Satoshi is a he or a she or a group. I am of the opinion that Satoshi is a single person, an individual, just from his writing. And he went by the pronoun he on his profile in the early days. So he gave himself that pronoun. So I want to dispel the, you know, controversy. Is Satoshi a male or a female? He said he was male. So I'm going to go with that. And I think just from the consistency of his writing over several years on these Bitcoin forums, it was a single person. It wasn't multiple people. So this individual figured out this critical problem by themselves. Wherever they were on Earth, they figured it out by themselves. So these people are all individualistic geniuses who were figuring out these really complex problems. But probably Satoshi is going to be the one who's remembered most in the history books. And unfortunately, the others will probably be footnotes.
Yeah. I mean, it's a triple crown. I mean, he kind of made the logical leap. He, to me, the immaculate appearance and disappearance is almost a feat as grand as Bitcoin. I don't know anyone in the world who could pull that off. I forgot the third
one. It's the greatest mystery. It will be the greatest mystery of this century. People will look back on this moment and say, how is it possible that our monetary system was invented by someone that no one knows about?
Yeah, and that's the third factor, that they walked away in terms of the unselfishness. So the ability to appear out of nowhere, the ability to disappear, that's one. The ability to put all this together, make the logical leap, that's two. And then walking away and not moving coins or taking value in a very transparent way or way that we know of, to me is remarkable. And as Nick Szabo explained in 2011, Nakamoto improved a significant security shortcoming that my design of BitGold had, namely by requiring a proof of work to be a node in the Byzantine resilient peer-to-peer system to lessen the threat of an untrustworthy party controlling the majority of nodes and thus corrupting a number of important security features. Yet another feature obvious in hindsight, quite non-obvious in foresight. My next question is sort of like, what kind of development took place on the Bitcoin network during the early years? You know, Satoshi's able to launch the initial version, has the Genesis block, it's working. What kind of development is kind of happening, just, you know, maybe from a very high level in those early years?
Actually, not that much. In the first year, there was a long periods when Satoshi was the only node in the network, and he mined a lot of the first million Bitcoins, just not because he was being greedy and he was, you know, trying to get a supply and then dump it on the public. We know that that's not the case because he disappeared and he's never transmitted any Bitcoins that he mined. He was mining Bitcoins for most of that first year to keep the network on. He had the only computer that was on the network. And there wasn't really much interest or development on Bitcoin. Most of the development was, you know, I'm talking about like the first few months to 6 months, was really a collaboration between Hal Finney and Satoshi. Hal said, you know, I tried to run your node and it crashed. Can you fix this? And Satoshi would be like, okay, I'll go and try and fix this. And Hal had a bunch of feedback and there was an email back and forth between them trying to fix basic bugs in the code. With the impression one gets when, you know, one looks at Satoshi's system is that he wasn't necessarily an expert engineer. He wasn't like, you know, a senior engineer at Apple or Google or something like that. He was someone who knew how to code and was, a brilliant person who was able to solve this, you know, incredibly difficult problem of computer science and game theory. But he wasn't a coder. And so his code had a lot of bugs in it. It had some significant bugs in it, an inflation bug where anyone could spend anyone else's Bitcoin. That was a huge bug in the early days. But eventually, after about a year or so, people started finding out about Bitcoin and getting interested and wanting to contribute. People like Gavin Andreessen and Mike Kern, who worked at Google, and they started contributing. Gavin made a lot of contributions to the Bitcoin repository in the early days. And as the network continued to function in about 2010, so the Bitcoin network really started operation in January 2009. But by 2010, there was definitely quite a few people who were interested in Bitcoin and working on development. And much of the development was fixing up Satoshi's code, making it easier to receive Bitcoins, adding functionality for wallets and things like that, making it, you know, barely useful. Because before then, it was very, very difficult to run Bitcoin. There was a point at which you had to actually be online to receive Bitcoins. And that was eventually fixed as well. Things like block explorers didn't really exist. It was a very, very primitive ecosystem. And even, you know, by late 2011, when I got interested in Bitcoin, that the ecosystem was still very, very primitive. I remember the first 5 Bitcoins that I received, my friend said, look, I've sent you 5 Bitcoins. And he showed me a block explorer, but I couldn't make heads or tail of it because it was terrible UI. It was just a string of numbers and letters. But I'd say by late 2010 and 2011, not only had an ecosystem, an economy begun to sprout up around Bitcoin, exchanges started to appear. This is when Mt. Gox was being built. The number of people who had become interested in Bitcoin had grown substantially. And a lot of people on the cryptography mailing list who had been skeptical of Bitcoin sort of moved over to saying we should work on Bitcoin now. And then it just grew exponentially from there to the point where the number of people contributing to Bitcoin would, you know, dozens to hundreds of people around the world. And you can see this in the Bitcoin forum in the early days. You can go back and look at these early posts and people asking Satoshi questions and asking how they could contribute. And people like Mike Kern going off and building his own version of Bitcoin Core. He built a Java-based version, whereas Satoshi built his version in C++. Mm. And eventually Satoshi disappeared in, I believe it's December, about December 2010, and was really not heard from again. And some people speculate it's because Gavin Andreessen went to the CIA to give a presentation on Bitcoin and Satoshi kind of freaked out and he didn't want his identity to be revealed. And this was a point at which Bitcoin was gaining a lot of attention and WikiLeaks had said they wanted to use Bitcoin to accept payments. And Satoshi thought that was a really bad idea because it would draw too much attention to Bitcoin. And Bitcoin was this very small, fragile community and network at the time that could probably have been killed quite easily with a government crackdown on it. So Satoshi was afraid of that. He was afraid of being revealed. And that was the point at which he disappeared and sort of disappeared into the history books. And we no longer know anything about him beyond what we have from the forums and his emails to various people in the cryptography mailing list.
What do you think Satoshi's concerns were around the vulnerabilities in those early years and around a government crackdown? Would it have been around like maybe a 51% attack that would have sort of embarrassed or sort of destroyed the credibility of the network? In what ways then would it have been let's use the term, more killable?
I think perhaps the government could say this is a currency which is it's unregulated. It's being used by criminals. It's being used by WikiLeaks. We need to shut it down and say usage of Bitcoin is just illegal. And I think that would have been like killing it in the cradle, because it would have, this is before really there was any, you know, widespread even knowledge that that it exists. And if most people's first exposure to Bitcoin was like, this is illegal, if you use it, you know, you'll get in trouble because it's only for people who do illegal things, that would have really hurt adoption. I think it perhaps adoption would have come back through underground activities over a very long period, maybe over, you know, 20 or 50 years, but it would have really slowed things down, if not killed it entirely. So it was, I think, correct of Satoshi to be concerned that Bitcoin's vulnerable in those early days. And I think he felt vulnerable as well, which is why he disappeared, because the amount of attention being devoted to Bitcoin was growing very, very rapidly. And then Silk Road came around and then it got really crazy. It's when you started hearing US senators saying that we need to crack down on this new illegal dark internet market and this currency that's being used to fund drug dealing online. We need to crack down on all of this stuff. So the first years were very, very rocky. People kind of forget it now because, you know, you have large institutions and corporations buying Bitcoin. But in the early days, it seemed really shady. And the people who were really interested in it were people who had an ideological affinity for human freedom, that people should be able to conduct voluntary trade with other people, even if that involves drugs. People with a very strong libertarian mindset were the ones most devoted to Bitcoin.
Yeah. I'm kind of curious what you think about, and I agree with everything you said there. I'm kind of curious what you think about Bitcoin's Lindy effect right now and where we are in sort of that aspect. So when I think about it, like a lot of people use like, oh, we're in, you know, the internet 1997. And I don't really agree with that full heartedly. I think it's more like the internet in like 1977 or like a rapnet. And it's just that things move faster because Bitcoin's been built on top of the internet. So everything is just going faster. So to get where the internet was maybe in 1997, it's only taken 12 years for Bitcoin. But I really think it's, comparatively speaking, it would be like the internet would be 12 years old in the 70s.
I can see both sides of that. When I say Bitcoin is, you know, the times I've said it's equivalent to the internet in the mid 90s, the point that I was trying to drive home is that it takes a certain amount of time before a technology seems like it's a permanent institution in the world. And the internet didn't really seem like that after, you know, during the 90s, when people, you started seeing large scale usage of the internet. It wasn't obvious that it was going to be an important institution in the world in the early 2000s. People were still struggling to understand why it was valuable at all. There's this funny article by Paul Krugman saying the internet will in the future will end up saying that the internet was no more consequential than the fax machine.
Yeah.
But by 2010, I think it was completely obvious that the internet was transformational, and it was transforming all sorts of different industries, and it was going to be a central part of our lives going forward. And I think of that in the same way with Bitcoin. I think after 10 years, it's still not clear to people how important this is. I think it'll take another 10 years when you have a whole generation of people who've grown up in a world knowing nothing about a world before Bitcoin. And to them, Bitcoin will be a permanent monetary institution. They'll think Bitcoin's always been around. It's been around since before I was born. And it's had value that whole time. So it seems like something that I can transact in and I can store value in. And I think that will be have a transformational effect when there's this new form of money, which is perfectly scarce, that people widely believe will exist forever. That changes your mindset. When you're in the mindset of, oh, Bitcoin's still a little sketchy, it's not, you know, it's new, it's this new digital money, a lot of people still kind of feel that way. They won't feel that way in 10 years. And so I think that that flipping of the majority of the world's population to think about Bitcoin as a permanent institution of the world will have a huge effect on society as a whole and people's willingness to adopt Bitcoin as their form of savings and their form of exchange.
Yeah. It's interesting. You worked at Google 20 years ago. And I don't know if you were there during this time, but like Google's first 5 years, I mean, Yahoo was worth a lot more money than Google. And Yahoo's crawling the web by hand with, you know, 40 people in a room trying to figure out what's on, how to index the web. And, you know, the smart money knew that Google was going to be worth more than Yahoo for those 5 years. It just took a while for the greater market to catch up. And it's interesting, we talked a little bit about the news cycle earlier, and you know, we have nation states entering Bitcoin now in terms of El Salvador making it legal tender. It's kind of a gray area. I don't know if they're stacking on their national reserves or buying for their sort of liquidity program with the wallet. I'm not really sure, but it seems like they're stacking. And that didn't set off any sort of bull run in the short term. It didn't kind of like, in fact, price went down. And it sort of makes me think about like the internet when you know, you had people like Krugman who didn't want to believe or didn't think the internet would have great value or and change the way we live. And it's interesting that like a country like El Salvador is beating us to this new sort of internet or this new platform in terms of just accepting it or beating other countries. I really hope that you guys are enjoying this conversation with Vijay as much as I am. And before we get back into it, I want to share with you some information about Bitcoin 2022 and some of the speakers they've announced for April 7th and 8th, including Elizabeth Stark, the CEO and co-founder of Lightning Labs, MicroStrategy Chairman and CEO Michael Saylor, Adam Back, CEO and co-founder of Blockstream, venture capitalist Elise Killeen, and former presidential candidate and now New York City mayoral candidate Andrew Yang. More speakers will be announced shortly. Bitcoin 2021 drew a record attendance of 12,000 to Miami in early June, bringing together founders, C-suite executives, Bitcoin experts, and Miami newcomers for discussions, networking events, and live performances. The Bitcoin 2022 conference, which celebrates Bitcoin over 4 days, April 6th to 9th next year, with four different passes. The 4 days include Industry Day, 2 days of main events and speakers, and lastly, a Festival Day, which is a day of music and networking. Prices will continue to rise over the next few months, so get in early and use my affiliate code for 10% off your tickets. Last year, I got to meet so many Bitcoiners that I met through the Bitcoin Matrix podcast or just shitposting on Twitter. Bitcoiners were everywhere, the hotel lobby, at the parties, at the beach, and I'm just so excited to get back to Miami and to see everyone again and meet even more fresh and dope Bitcoiners. So when you check out for your tickets, remember to use the code Bitcoin Matrix and get 10% off your tickets to Bitcoin 2022. You're not going to want to miss this incredible event. And now, let's re-enter the Bitcoin Matrix with Vijay, where we get into El Salvador, nation state adoption, and Bitcoin as legal tender. What did you make of sort of this period in time where nations are kind of interacting with Bitcoin in some ways, and it's not triggered sort of the final cycle in the way we would have thought about it?
So I want to answer that question, but I also want to go back to a comment you made about Yahoo because it brought up a memory for me. When I joined Google, I had a job offer from both Google and Yahoo, and Yahoo offered me significantly more money because Yahoo was a public established company and Google was still just a startup. And I remember asking a friend of mine, what do I do? I mean, at the time I didn't have any money. I just come to the United States with really no money at all. And so it was a very difficult decision. It wasn't obvious that Google was going to be this huge success. Just like in 2010 or 11, it might not have been obvious that Bitcoin was going to be a huge success. And my friend said, the only rational point of having money is to help make you happy. So if you can work at a company that makes you happy, that's worth a lot of money. And so when he said that to me, it made the decision obvious. I knew that I'd be way happy working at Google at the time. It was, you know, a very different company. It was a startup. It was really exciting. The people were super bright. Whereas Yahoo felt very corporate, and the people who were working there didn't seem like they're having much fun. So the decision was obvious, and, you know, it worked out financially as well. It wasn't obvious that it would at the time. But, you know, you bringing that up brought up that memory in my head. To get back to El Salvador and the adoption of nation states, I think the case of El Salvador is a little bit of an anomaly. It's not quite what we expect of nation state adoption that would trigger kind of this game theory of other nation states jumping on board, because El Salvador is firstly a very small country. It's a country which doesn't have its own currency. It's a dollarized country. Mm. And so they already are using someone else's money. And so to add another form of money as legal tender isn't so revolutionary. It's not like they're throwing away this big part of their sovereignty. A country which is controlling its own money has a very strong incentive to not allow competition. So to see a country in that kind of position allow Bitcoin to become legal tender or to add it to their reserves now, that would be very, very newsworthy. And I think the other thing which is kind of interesting about El Salvador is they have a president who has incredibly strong political mandate. He's very, very popular in his country, I think 90% approval ratings. And it's very hard to make a change like this to say, we're going to adopt this new internet money as legal tender in our country, unless you have a lot of political capital. And there aren't many political leaders on earth. You think about the United States, for instance, when a president is elected, they have very little political capital because half the country already hates them. And we live in a very, very polarized society where it's very difficult to get anything done. So El Salvador is very exciting, and it's a great experiment because I think it's going to show other countries the benefit of doing this and adopting Bitcoin. Certainly in Latin America, I think it could have a tremendous effect for the countries down there if their populations adopt Bitcoin and the savings of those countries rise dramatically as Bitcoin is monetized around the world. But I don't think this is the kind of nation state adoption which is going to trigger the game theory yet. If we see another country, and there are a number of other countries where it seems like it might happen, then the ball could start rolling much more quickly than it is now.
Yeah. I'm kind of curious when there's going to be, or if there's going to be, that Charles de Gaulle moment where, you know, a leader of a country sort of declares in some way that would be applicable to the 21st century, but we're not going to take this anymore, you know, send battleships to get their gold or whatever it is. And I don't think it's El Salvador at the moment. I think that's sort of the inflection point when it's a country like Germany or Russia or China, and, you know, it does take scale. I'd love for you to talk about, you know, potential Bitcoin returns let's say you're looking at it from an investment perspective in an outcome where Bitcoin becomes the world's reserve currency and the inflow of savings to it stabilizes. Would there still be returns on Bitcoin in purchasing power?
Yes, absolutely. Because what would happen is that you'd have a fixed supply of money. You'd have 21 million Bitcoins, or, you know, modulo the amount that had been lost. You'd have a fixed number of Bitcoins circulating, and you'd have global adoption, which would mean that everyone would own Bitcoin and they'd be transacting in Bitcoin. What the returns you'd see on Bitcoin held would be the productivity of the global economy. So if the global economy was growing by 5% a year, someone holding a Bitcoin would have essentially a 5% return, so that their purchasing power would increase by 5%. And this is basically what happened under a gold standard, that people who held gold would see their purchasing power increase slightly over time. Whereas the current system we live in, where the money supply increases, the purchasing power of a dollar held over time decreases over time because of inflation. When the money supply is essentially fixed, the purchasing power goes up rather than down over time. But it doesn't go up in a like 50% or 100% per year as is happening now. The reason that's happening is because Bitcoin is in the early stages of its monetization. Once it's fully monetized, the growth of Bitcoin will slow dramatically, and not everyone will want to hold Bitcoin because some people will have a greater risk appetite and they'll invest their Bitcoin perhaps in a stock market or in a company to get more than 5% returns. So people who are good at allocating capital won't hold as much Bitcoin, they'll invest it. But regular savers, people like doctors and teachers and policemen and people like that, will feel comfortable holding their savings in Bitcoin, knowing that the value of those savings will increase slowly over time.
Yeah, that's interesting. I love that. And that kind of like really just gets at like either some people say everything divided by 21 million, but really just purchasing power. And even in a future world, I think it's important to kind of understand that Bitcoin would still accrue value in relative terms in that scenario. I'm kind of curious what you think about like a project like Libra. And, you know, and what that represents, whether they get that off the ground or not.
I think Facebook in particular is a very, very difficult position, a difficult regulatory position, because they are widely hated as a company, and they are doing something which undermines a sovereign power of nation states, which is the transmission of value and the control of the transmission of value. So I don't believe it's even possible for them to achieve what they say they're trying to achieve, because it takes both political capital as well as sort of technical capital to make something like this happen. They certainly have the technical capital, you know, enough bright engineers to build a system like this. It's not too difficult to build to build a system like this. But because they're a widely hated company, especially, you know, in the United States, a lot of people believe that they influenced one of the past elections. They believe that Facebook isn't controlling hate speech. Facebook isn't like regulating the way people communicate on their platform. They have a lot of political headwind to get something as consequential as a new monetary system built. I just think it's politically completely infeasible that this can happen.
Yeah. I thought it would have been more feasible and a tremendous Trojan horse against the fiat system if they rolled out just a dollar parity coin, some sort of stable coin, and sort of got the backing of the U.S. government to almost do monetary colonialism on behalf of the U.S. dollar. And then I think over time, if they were able to switch that to sort of a basket of goods, would be the way that they would have gotten that in. And I was surprised that they made the leap to their own sort of denominated money right away.
Yeah, the reason they can't do that, right? Because they're a platform that exists in many countries. And so they have to consider the political effect in all of those different countries. And if you were trying to Trojan horse the dollar into, you know, Russia or China or, you know, the European Union, they will be very unhappy with that. So this is probably why they came up with this idea of a basket of currencies, just so it seemed seen more global. The one thing Facebook has, and I agree with you a little bit on this, is this idea of a Trojan horse. They have massive distribution. They if they created a monetary system, they would be able to distribute to half the world instantly, which is very, very powerful, which is why they got so much political pushback. I think the people in the halls of power understand that this distribution is very, very powerful, but they also won't let Facebook get away with it. And it has the problem that, going all the way back to the start of the episode, that David Chalm's company DigiCash had, it's a centralized system, and centralized systems are easily coercible and they're easy to shut down. So if the government didn't like what Facebook was doing, they could just go knock on Mark Zuckerberg's door and say, stop right now or you go to jail. And that's the fundamental weakness. And that's why whatever they create will never be as powerful as Bitcoin, will never have the same value proposition of Bitcoin, which is the only truly decentralized money and the only monetary system where we can rely on its monetary policy and its supply cap. So, you know, when it came around that they were doing this, a lot of people said, this is the Bitcoin killer. And it was, you know, completely obvious to me that that is absolutely not the case. This is a completely different beast. It's much more akin to David Chalmers' attempt, which failed, and a number of these early attempts, which are centralized, which failed. Bitcoin succeeded because it was decentralized, and that's what makes it unique.
Yeah. Speaking of decentralization or the counter and centralization, a lot of people have concerns around miner centralization. And I'm kind of curious, what is Bitcoin's nuclear option that it could deploy in the case of extreme, you know, miner centralization or some sort of attack in that regard?
Yeah, so people were getting concerned that there was a lot of Bitcoin's hash power was concentrated in China. And if China, you know, Chinese state wanted to shut down Bitcoin, they could just confiscate all these miners and shut down the factories and foundries which create the chips that are used in these miners. And that was a concern. Interestingly, China banned mining in their country. And this seemed like a huge negative for Bitcoin. It was one of the precipitating factors in this recent Bitcoin correction, which is almost, you know, we've come back from the depths of this correction. And what happened was all of those miners moved to other countries. All of that mining capacity found new sources of power around the world. And China, at the stroke of a pen, decentralized the entire mining industry, which is fantastic. But if we go back to the question, the theoretical question, what if there was enough mining power concentrated in one country that a nation state tried to attack it, or multiple nation states tried to shut down mining? The nuclear option for Bitcoin is a change in the proof of work function. The proof of work function for Bitcoin is SHA-256. It's a particular function for producing hashes. You have to create a valid Bitcoin hash, you have to create hashes over and over again very, very quickly until you find one which has a particular pattern. And the pattern is a long string of zeros at the front of the hash. And so this, you have to expend a lot of energy to do this. But if you changed this proof of work function, it would render all of the mining hardware that was used for Bitcoin completely worthless instantly. So if the network came to consensus that because Bitcoin is under attack by a nation state, we all agree that we're going to shift our proof of work function, whatever hardware that nation state was using to attack Bitcoin would instantly be worthless. It wouldn't work with the new mining function. So you could change from SHA-256 to SHA-512, for instance. And if you had a specific piece of hardware which is very good at mining SHA-256, it wouldn't work for SHA-512. So this is a nuclear option. I say this is a nuclear option because it's very unlikely that this will ever come up. But if it did, it would also be very contentious. Changing the proof of work function is a foundational building block of the Bitcoin system. And to change it, you would really need to get everyone on board. Otherwise, you'd have all sorts of network splits. You might have one group say, we want to use this function, and another group say, we use this function, and then Bitcoin would splinter into, you know, many, many different pieces. And that would be very harmful for the network. So the option exists, but it's nuclear. It would be both sides would face a lot of damage to do it. The side attacking Bitcoin would lose the value of their hardware, and the network would face a lot of contention from people disagreeing about what proof of work function to shift to, or whether to even shift proof of work function at all.
Yeah. Well, it was really something I never heard of that option before. And I love that there's always these kind of workouts that we have as options, whether, you know, if we can all agree on it, which is extremely hard. And so I like that aspect of it, but there's just everywhere you go, there's this Swiss Army knife of, well, we could do this then, or we could do that. And it's just a very powerful thing. My final question to you is, how is Bitcoin, like gold, combined with the SWIFT system? And maybe just sort of like explain what the SWIFT system is a little bit to kind of, you know, kind of help there a little bit.
Yes, the SWIFT system is a system that's existed for many decades. It's a system to allow interbank transfers of value between banks in the global market. So gold has the problem due to its physicality that's hard to move. And if you are a bank which has reserves in one country held in gold, and you want to settle with another bank in another country because, say, a bunch of your customers sent checks to the other bank, you need to settle by giving them that value in gold. You actually have to send the physical gold, which is risky and costly and time consuming. And the settlement may take weeks. I mean, you think about also nation states doing this, where they say, we want our gold back. And you have to send a ship with gold bars on it across the Atlantic Ocean. And that's very, very risky. And there are times historically where sovereign authorities wanted to send gold, and the way they sent it ended up losing them all the gold, like the ship sunk. And there were Roman ships that sunk, which had a lot of gold on them, that were discovered, you know, millennia later. So Bitcoin is, the way I describe it, is Bitcoin is kind of like gold with teleportation built in. It's a digital money that exists on the internet that can be transmitted to anyone anywhere on Earth near instantly. So it also has kind of the same power of the SWIFT network, which is you can have settlement between financial institutions very quickly. The difference is, though, the settlement is in a form of money that no one controls. It's not controlled by a government, and it's not controlled by the banks. So it has those similarities with gold. It's non-sovereign. Gold is a form of money that's not controlled by any government. It exists on its own. But gold is very inconvenient to move. So it's one way of thinking about it. Bitcoin is like gold built into the SWIFT system.
Yeah. And just to follow up on that, does it kind of give you what you would call like super property rights?
Yeah, that's another thing I've described about Bitcoin, in that the fact that it's not physical, it's an intangible good, and that it's decentralized means that you don't need an apparatus of coercion to maintain your property right. An apparatus of coercion is usually what people think of as the government, and the government maintains property rights. So you have a tennis racket or something, and I steal your tennis racket. The way you get your tennis racket back is you appeal to the apparatus of coercion, which is the government, because we have physical possessions and we need some apparatus to keep them safe. But Bitcoin is different to that because it's digital and intangible. You can walk across borders being fully secure in your Bitcoin just simply because no one even knows you have it. It's just like a private key in your head. Whereas if you were to walk across a border with, say, $50 million of gold, you better believe that you'd want some kind of apparatus of coercion protecting your property rights, because that can be taken and people can see that you have like a heavy bag, or you go through customs and they scan your bag and say, sir, why do you have all of this gold? So Bitcoin gives you a property right, the ability to control something very valuable, which doesn't rely on that apparatus of coercion. So I call that a super property right.
Yeah, that's awesome. What a time to be alive. I do want to read a couple of quotes, one from Hal. Imagine that Bitcoin is successful and becomes the dominant payment system in use throughout the world. Then the total value of the currency should be equal to the total value of all the wealth in the world. Current estimates of total worldwide household wealth that I have found range from 100 trillion to 300 trillion. With 20 million coins, that gives each coin a value of about 10 million. That's a quote from Hal Finney. And it really does make you think about, or made me think about, how much he thought about Bitcoin before its existence, for him to have that kind of perspective very early on. I think that was within a year or two of Bitcoin coming out. And just to round it out with some of your words, and a quote you put in the book: beyond the financial case for Bitcoin, its rise as a non-sovereign store of value will have profound geopolitical consequences. A global non-inflationary reserve currency will force nation states to alter their primary funding mechanism from inflation to direct taxation, which is far less politically palatable. States will shrink in size commensurate to the political pain of transitioning to taxation as their exclusive means of funding. Furthermore, global trade will be settled in a manner that satisfies Charles de Gaulle's aspiration that no nation should have privilege over any other. We consider it necessary that international trade be established as it was the case before the great misfortunes of the world on an indisputable monetary base, and one that does not bear the mark of any particular country. That was a quote from Charles de Gaulle, and you wrote, 50 years from now, that monetary base will be Bitcoin. and what a future for our children that I hope and aspire for. It's a little concerning and alarming out there, and I think Bitcoin's our greatest hope. So I can't tell you how much I've appreciated our conversation. We didn't get to cover everything. There's so many questions for Vijay. But in terms of, you know, where we are in the world, I think one of the points you hit on in the book is that, you know, most people don't have huge bricks of gold in their house or even just a lot of gold or whatever it is, and ownership over the world's a piece of the world's monetary base. And right now, because we're in the infancy of Bitcoin, we actually have that opportunity to own a piece. And in the future, and I think you lay out this point well, you're going to, you know, people who do have large chunks now, those chunks will get broken up and distributed over time. But, you know, what an opportunity at hand. And, you know, and I kind of, my final question to you before we roll out and you let everyone know where they can find you is, you know, when you got involved with the Ron Paul campaign and you started studying Austrian economics and computer science and you were a much younger man, did you ever think we would be sitting where we are now with something like Bitcoin on hand?
Absolutely not. No, I was really dejected after the Ron Paul campaign because I got to see the political process up close and I thought it was really depressing. So I feel like the future is a lot more optimistic in a lot of ways. And I'm very excited that we have something, a way to escape the system. If we think the system is failing us, then we have an escape hatch now. And it's a ray of hope for people around the world. A lot of people, it's very important. So I'm excited about our future, and I'm excited to keep talking about Bitcoin with people because I feel like it does provide hope for the masses around the world.
Yeah. Yeah, man, I can't agree more. I'm super excited. It's the thing that gives me the most hope outside of my wife and kids and just, you know, being with real people every day. So I can't tell you how much I've enjoyed this, Vijay. Anytime I get to connect with you, please let everyone know where they could find you. And right after this, I'll probably DM you and schedule some time to talk about some of the biggest problems ahead.
You can find me on Twitter. I'm real_Vijay. So real_Vijay. And you can find my website, Bullish Case for Bitcoin, with links to my book. And I'm probably going to create a store online. I'm starting to work on translations, Spanish, Portuguese, Polish, Turkish, and a number of other languages, where you'll be able to find copies of my book in those other languages. Because, you know, Bitcoin's not just for us English speakers, it's for the world. And people in other countries outside the United States probably could benefit even more than us. So I want to get these ideas out to the world and tell people why Bitcoin's so important.
Yeah, I can't wait for you to put up the store. I have my 10 copies. I've been giving out to friends and family, but I know there's people on Twitter that are like, how'd you get so many? When can I get mine? And, I know the Kickstarter campaign was a great success, but you got to get the store up. So I'm excited for that.
Yeah.
It's been super great.
Thanks for your support as well, Cedric. I really appreciate it.
Thanks so much, man. Thank you so much. It's been dope. This episode with Vijay Boyapati is brought to you by the good people over at Ledin, the fun people over at Bitcoin Magazine, and the Bitcoin 2022 conference. Ledin.io is a secure, simple, and easy-to-use platform for managing and growing your digital wealth. If you want to see what it's all about and get $50 free in USDC when you take out your first Ledin loan, head over to start.ledin.io/Bitcoin Matrix. Last year, over 10,000 Bitcoiners came to celebrate Bitcoin at Bitcoin 2021. And for Bitcoin 2022, they are expecting tens of thousands of rabid Bitcoiners. It's going to be off the hook. I can't wait to see you all there. Let's have some beers and celebrate Bitcoin. For 10% off, use my code BitcoinMatrix and check the show notes for the link and more details. And thank you for listening. If you dig the chats, please make sure to subscribe, rate, review, and share with your friends and family. Stack sats, stay humble, and stay laser focused during Pumptober. This is Cedric. Peace.